Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along with us this noon as we talk about the importance of culinary herbs and spices in our lives. Our guest is Ian Herbie Hemphill of Sydney, Australia, who runs a large specialty spice shop which offers the largest selection of herbs and spices for sale and export in the Southern Hemisphere. He's the author of the Spice and Herb Bible, second edition, published by Robert Rose. And thank you very much, Herbie, for joining with us today.
It's a pleasure, Jim.
I'm glad to have you with us, and I know that your first edition of the Spice and Herb Bible was a success, sold more than 30,000 copies in this country alone, and that was 5 years ago. What's happened to bring on this second edition?
Well, it's quite interesting. When you write about something at the time, you think you've covered just about everything that could be covered. And but, of course, as time goes on, you continue to find out more. There are some of the spices that we've written about that we hadn't written about before. And one of the big changes to this edition, too, well, there's a couple, but a very big one is we've added a lot of recipes to it. And many of these recipes were contributed by our eldest daughter, Kate, who is a chef and lives in London.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kate has contributed over 60 recipes to this book. And in addition to that, there's a lot more information about making spice blends, about putting the actual spices together, because very often people will look at spices just as individual items and they'll think of cumin and coriander seed and paprika and chili. But it's really when you start to blend these spices and put them together and you make a seasoning that will give a Moroccan flavor to a dish, or you make something that will give a very distinctly Indian profile, or a very interesting Thai-type flavor. That's when spices become really interesting, when you start to blend them together. So we've added quite a bit more about that as well.
You learned how to grow, select, and dry herbs and spices when you were a boy. Your parents were in the business, were they not?
Yes, they were among the really the pioneers of people using a lot of herbs and spices in Australia. My mother was the first Australian to write a book on herbs in 1959, and my family had a herb nursery in a little rural area outside of Sydney. So I did grow up with them, and Dad was propagating them, and Mum was developing recipes, and so they were very much a part of my life from an early age, and that was one of the reasons why I got the nickname Herbie when I was at school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Ian is a perfectly wonderful name.
Yeah, it does the job.
But Herbie as a spice master, then that's definitely the right name to have.
Yeah, well, it's a name that sort of was a nickname that I got when I was a kid, and it stuck with me ever since.
Our guest is Herbie Hemphill of Sydney, Australia. He's written the Spice and Herb Bible, second edition, published by Robert Rose. And if you'd like to join in with questions about herbs and spices, then give us a call. The number in Madison is a local number, 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. That is a toll-free call. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is no ordinary lightweight book, Herbie. It's got to weigh at least 5 pounds.
It does. It's about 600 pages, and it did take quite a while to put together.
One of the things that I noticed in here is that you are able to define for someone like myself, who's not a gourmet chef, what the difference is between an herb and a spice.
Yes, and it's one of those things that it's a question that is most often asked of me, and it really serves as a fairly basic definition, but it is fairly handy to understand the difference because it does affect the way you use them. And a herb is essentially the leafy part of the plant that we pick and use in cooking. So if you think of parsley and dill and basil and oregano, all of those we refer to as herbs, and with them we pick the leafy part and use it. The spice, on the other hand, can be come from many different parts of the plant. So it can actually be the buds, as in the case of cloves, which are the dried, unopened bud from a tree.
Mm-hmm.
They can be cinnamon, which comes from the bark of a tree. They can be something like peppercorns, which are, of course, the berries from a vine. Spices can be the aromatic seeds from a plant when it's finished flowering. So this is quite interesting. We get a coriander plant where we call the fresh leaves cilantro, and we use those and call them a herb. But when the plant has flowered and gone to seed and we collect that seed, we call the seed a spice.
Hmm.
So there are lots of seed spices, such as dill seed, caraway seed, coriander seed that I mentioned, fenugreek seed, etc. Then, of course, we've got unusual parts of plants, such as vanilla, which comes from the pod of the tropical climbing orchid. There is also saffron, which is the stigma, which is picked from an autumn flowering crocus. So spices are actually a very broad group of items. And a lot of people think of spices as being hot. We find in Australia, and I think it's the same in the States too, where a lot of people will say, you know, they don't like spicy food.
It's too spiced up.
Too spicy, yeah. When in actual fact, what they're really saying is it's got too much chili or pepper in it. They're not saying that they don't like something like cinnamon or they don't like vanilla in ice cream. So you've really got to think of spices as being a much broader category, a much broader term than something that is just hot. And, of course, you use herbs and spices a little bit differently. The majority of herbs we tend to use in most cooking in their fresh form. So if you take something like fresh oregano or marjoram, fresh basil, fresh cilantro, it has a beautiful, delicate flavour, a very light profile. The aroma that you get from it comes from the top notes that are in there that give it its characteristic flavour. When that herb is dried, the flavour tends to change quite a bit, and it's not the same. So we use fresh herbs in dishes generally that are not going to be cooked for very long. And it's actually advisable not to cook fresh herbs for too long. So you can use them in stir fries, you can put them into omelets and scrambled egg, you can tear them up and put them through salads. But if you're going to cook a dish like a casserole, which is a long, slow-cooked dish, and you want to use, say, thyme, sage, marjoram and rosemary in that, then we would always recommend adding the dried herb at the beginning of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flavour of the dried herb will be stronger. It will be a little bit different to the flavour of the fresh herb, but it will be the flavour that will work well with that slow-cooked dish. And, you know, people often compare dried and fresh and say, oh, you know, fresh herbs are superior to dried. It really does depend on the cooking application. As I often say to people, you wouldn't make a cup of tea with fresh tea leaves.
Mm-hmm. So, I see what you mean.
Yeah, so and you get a stronger, better infusion. So dried herbs do have their role. When it comes to spices, what is particularly interesting about them is the majority of them actually have to be dried to get their flavour. So if you take something like a fresh vanilla bean from the vanilla orchid, it's completely tasteless, and it has no vanilla flavour whatsoever and no aroma. And it's only after it's gone through a long curing process that the enzymes that naturally occur within the vanilla bean give it its flavour, and that gives us the spice vanilla. And the same thing happens with spices like cloves and allspice, star anise, lots of different spices, all achieve their flavour when they actually dry. So there are very distinct differences between the two.
And it depends on the application you use them in.
And it really depends on the application, that's right. But the majority of spices are not used fresh. There's only a handful of items we classify as spices.
All right. Herbie Hemphill is our guest. He's from Sydney, Australia, the author of The Spice and Herb Bible, second edition, published by Robert Rose. It's about 600 pages, 608 actually, with background on more than 100 herbs and spices from around the world, dozens of innovative recipes, all of which were created by his daughter, Kate. And the first edition came out 5 years ago. Now we have the second edition. And if you'd like to join in with a question or a comment, we'd be happy to get your call in Madison at 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. And Marion is in Windsor. And Marion, what's on your mind today?
I was cleaning out my cupboard the other day with spices and such, and I have some pau d'arco in it, and it's it looks kind of like brownish barky stuff, and I don't remember what I bought it for. I think it was more medicinal than culinary, but can you tell me anything about it?
That one definitely sounds like a medicinal one to me. It's definitely not a common culinary one, so I'm afraid I can't help you on that one. It's interesting, the medicinal area is one where you do get a number of items that overlap, and you'll get spices that will be used for both medicinal and culinary purposes. But there are also quite a few that are medicinal only. And, of course, those really should only be used under some form of instruction or direction from a health professional, because many of the medicinal herbs and spices do have quite high active ingredients in them, and you have to make sure that they would not have any sort of synergy or cause any sort of issues with other medicines that one might be taking. So it'd be a good idea to get some maybe professional advice on that from a health professional or a herbalist.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Marion, thank you very much.
Sorry, I couldn't help you there.
We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Dan next in New Richmond. Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I've had trouble growing herbs indoors. I'd like to have a recommendation for setting up a pretty much bulletproof herb garden in my kitchen that I can use for culinary reasons.
A very good question. And if you come up with the absolute solution to that, you'll become a multimillionaire. herbs really do not like to grow indoors. They need sunshine and they need fresh air. The closest you can get is to perhaps grow them in a window box. You can have some success growing them right next to a window if it's open most of the time and it gets sun for, say, a good 4 or 5 hours of the day. But in reality, you really need them to be outdoors. And you may have heard the old English expression about a kitchen garden. And this was always a garden that was grown very close to the kitchen. And so you may need to do that. Pots will also, herbs will also grow very well in pots and hanging baskets. So that's often the way people will grow them. They'll have little balcony gardens if they don't actually have a garden. So you can grow them in pots, but they really do need the sunshine and the fresh air, I'm afraid.
Dan?
Okay. I was wondering if you could put heat, like a heat source underneath a pot, if that would help to help the plant thrive when it's colder air in the house.
Look, it would help to a degree. I think you would probably need, as well as warmth, you would also need a fairly good light source. You know, there are varying degrees of agriculture that have been used. People will grow some things by hydroponics in igloos where you have temperature control and you have a daylight-like light source. Often these sorts of growing environments are the ones that are used for cultivating illicit substances. But look, you can do it to a degree, but for the general home use, you would find that you would have probably fairly limited success.
All right, so illegal herbs are your best bet for hydroponics. I gotcha.
All right, Dan. Thanks very much for your call. I'm not sure that was the right answer you were looking for. Tell me about two myths that I noticed in the book. Yes or no, spices were used in the old days to mask the taste of rotten food.
Yes, this is an interesting one, and I must admit I find it a bit curious when I read this. It's amazing how many people say it. I find it very hard to believe that this would be the case, because back in the sort of times when they were talking about, spices were a very expensive commodity. Really, up until about the 18th century, spices were very expensive, not something that the average person could get their hands on. And going back even further, they were something that nobility and people who were quite well off could get their hands on. Now, there's a basic fact that if food is rotten, then generally human beings can't eat it. You know, as we know, the pet dog can eat just about anything without any problems at all. But, of course, if a human being eats rotten meat, then most likely it will kill them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the notion of putting spices on rotten food to make it edible really isn't quite plausible. However, I do believe where the myth developed was the fact that spices may have been used to improve the flavour of foods that may have been a little bit strong or not terribly pleasant. So mm-hmm. if you think of, you know, mutton, or what we call in Australia mutton, which is basically a mature sheep, the flavour of that can be very strong and very lanolin-like. And if you flavour that with spices, of course it's going to taste a lot nicer.
And as far as spices are preservatives, yes or no?
Not really. They do have some antimicrobial properties, and they will assist in the preservation process. But food preservation is a very straightforward process where basically, traditionally, you've always used a food acid such as vinegar, or you've used salt, or you've used the heat of cooking. And those things will have enough antimicrobial properties to prevent the food from spoiling. Spices on their own really do not act as a preservative. So you can't sprinkle spices over some food and think, oh, well, that'll now last a little bit longer. I don't have to put it in the refrigerator because it would still go off. So spices are often used in conjunction with the preservation process, but they are not actually preservatives on their own.
All right. Jeanette in Rush County, let's give you a chance. Hello.
Hi. Terrific show as always. Brief comment. Success that I've had with herbs indoors, predominantly rosemary and thyme in a room with large windows to the south and to the west. I use a hydrometer to watch the moisture content of the soil, and I run a humidifier.
Right. Okay.
And I had herb plants, thyme, principally thyme, that have gotten very large and very lovely. They become members of the family almost. And I am mobile, so I will go off.
All right, Jeanette.
The rest of the program to my radio.
Thank you so much for your call. And if you'd like to join in, we have lines open for you in Madison at 263-1890, and elsewhere it's 800-642-1234. You talked earlier about the combination of spices, using and making spice blends, and I noticed that you have more than 50 pages devoted to that topic.
Yes, yes, and I think it's becoming more and more important. If you go into the supermarket now, you'll see there are literally dozens and dozens of spice blends. And one of the things that I always recommend people do is to have a look at the label of a spice blend, because, you know, you get very good spice blends that are made just from spices, and you get lots of spice blends that have got fillers and free-flow agents. They've got artificial colours. They're often very high in sugar and salt. And I think you get a better result when you make a spice blend really just from the natural spices. And as I said earlier, you can have just a handful of spices and you start to put them together and you create a number of different flavour profiles. And in the book I've put, to help people sort of get their minds around it, because a lot of people find it difficult to really get their minds around the quantities that they should use. They think if they put, you know, too much of a strong spice like cardamom in, that it's going to ruin the whole dish. So what I've tried to do in the spice blending section is have a spice pyramid that that gives an idea as to the proportions of the different spices you would use to make a balanced blend. And in order to communicate this, I've divided spices into five main flavor categories. And those main flavor categories are spices that are sweet, ones that are pungent, ones that are tangy, ones that are hot, and ones that are amalgamating. And then once you see the proportions that these different spices are used in, you can start to understand how they come together. So, for instance, if you were making a spice blend and you used just a small amount of hot spice, a little bit of pungent, a reasonable quantity of tangy and sweet, and quite a lot of an amalgamating spice, say like coriander seed or sweet paprika, you're going to end up with a balanced blend. And so this way, people can do all sorts of experimenting and they can know they're not going to end up with a disaster.
I know that many of your spices are now distributed in this country by an outfit called Uplink International.
Yes.
And sent along a couple of samples of some of your gourmet spices from Herbie Spices, and one of them is it the Ras El Hanou, the
yes.
Moroccan blend?
Yes.
Is that
yes.
how it's pronounced?
Ras El Hanou or Ras El Hanout.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a very interesting blend. It's a Moroccan blend, and what's interesting about Ras El Hanout is that the name actually means top of the shop. So in Morocco, where the spice traders are, a spice trader will sell all his different blends, but his piece de resistance, his one that is, you know, the top of the shelf, will be his Ras El Hanout. And although every spice blender will make his Ras El Hanout a little bit differently, they will all have a similar flavour profile. You'll know what to expect from a Ras El Hanout, no matter who makes it.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, some people will make it better than others. And the interesting thing about it is it contains probably more spices than just about any other spice blend. It can contain over 20 different spices. And I find it very interesting that you would initially think that a spice blend with 20 different spices in it would taste like a bit of a dog's breakfast. But the reality is it's a beautiful blend. It's very fragrant, it's not overly spiced, and it's used in a wide range of dishes. And when I made Ras El Hanout, I looked at a lot of traditional recipes, developed this specific blend, but I must admit I did leave out the traditional ingredients of Spanish fly and hashish.
And that's probably a good thing for an American audience, I would imagine. Herbie, thank you so much for spending time with us. The time has flown, and I've enjoyed talking with you very much. Good luck to you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you too, Jim.
Thank you. Herbie Hemphill, Sydney, Australia, runs a specialty spice shop, which you can find out more about at herbies.com.au for Australia. And thanks to him, thanks to Steve Williams for on-air phone production, and to you for your calls. And we hope you're around tomorrow. We'll be talking about the top 10 astronomy stories of 2006 and the world's greatest marvels, mysteries, and myths.